a stack of chapel music scores tucked under his arm. He looked every inch the lost musical genius that he swiftly became in the eyes of the world. The media went crazy for him. The public went crazy for him. And overnight, the whole world found out about the Piano Man. The name was almost too perfect, considering the double meaning of fugue, a piece of music made up of many voices repeating the same melody. The media storm that brewed became a fugue in itself. So many voices. People demanding to know who he was, where he came from, but most importantly, what had happened to him. It played out loud and brash across the tabloids, and for one summer the Piano Man caught the imagination of the world. The public projected their own stories, their hopes and fears onto his blank expression. Meanwhile, British neurologists, doctors, psychiatric nurses, and a host of other medical professionals fumbled and fudged different treatment plans while the police tried to track his family down, none of which came to anything. Until, finally, one day, the Piano Man decided to speak. And what he said wasn't what anyone had expected. He wasn't the man the world was hoping for. He was simply an ordinary man. An imperfect, broken person, just trying to disappear. He'd been misdiagnosed. He wasn't in a fugue state, and he didn't have retrograde amnesia. The National Health Service, police force, and government came under scrutiny for their complete and utter mismanagement of the whole case. The Piano Man was thrown out with the rubbish, a sad malingerer, a fraud who'd fooled everyone. But I wouldn't call what he did malingering. That seems harsh. Malingerers tend to fake for financial gain or to avoid incarceration or military drafting, but the Piano Man just wanted to escape his everyday life for a while. Richard's tone is soft, parental.
I'd take the case myself if I wasn't already neck deep here at MIT. You know, I haven't had a potential fugue for years now. There's a lot I'd do differently, a lot I know you'd do differently.
He's right. I've never had a fugue patient. There aren't that many around, and men like Richard, with years of clinical experience, tend to scoop them up. Groves has treated cases similar to this one, although he had nothing to do with the Piano Man case. Though he did work on a similar case, unknown young male, in 1999. It was the case where the 20-year-old patient wandered into the Buffalo General Medical Center in upstate New York, soaking wet, with a shaved head, asking if anyone could help him find his way home, as he couldn't remember where he lived or who he was. In fact, there aren't many fugue patients Richard hasn't worked with. He led on the Lost Man case in 2007, where a businessman came to on a subway in Denver with no memory of his life up until that moment. And the case of patient H.G., Heather Goodman, who found herself in a Starbucks queue in Portland with no wallet or idea of who she was or how she got there. It turned out her amnesia was epilepsy-led, and she regained her full memory after only 10 days. Richard has consulted on almost all the recorded fugue cases over the last 30 years, which is why he's the go-to specialist for cases like this. But that might change. That could change. If this goes well, and it could go well, couldn't it? I'll do it, I say before I can think of the million reasons why it's a terrible idea and talk myself out of it.
Great, that's excellent news, Emma.
Richard crows, and I feel a warmth spread right through me.
Good, I had a feeling you would. Now, listen, I hope you don't mind, but...
There's a sharp bang on the door, and Millie pops her head around. Richard continues...
There should be someone turning up there soon. I didn't want to be
Millie waves for me to listen, her face uncharacteristically animated. Sorry, Richard, one second, I say, lowering the phone. What is it? I ask.
There's someone here to see you. He doesn't have an appointment that I can see, but Greg from Caroline Miller's office has just called and said that the appointment has already been okayed with them. With Caroline Miller.
Millie's voice is hushed, but her pitch is high. Caroline Miller is the chief executive of the whole hospital. We only ever see her at events and general meetings.
Did you know about this?
What's the person's name? Millie blinks at me blankly.
Oh, sorry. His name is Peter Chorley?
I nod. Ah, okay, well, that makes sense. Thanks, Millie. Tell him I'll be out in a second. I don't know whether to be pleased or annoyed that Richard was so certain I'd say yes. But then I suppose he's a neuropsychiatrist, and human nature isn't exactly brain surgery, is it? Oh, wait, it kind of is. I lift the receiver back to my ear as Millie slips out of the room. I think whoever was on their way is here, Richard.
Ah, perfect timing. I'll leave you to it then. Listen, let me know how it goes. I'm interested. Your secretary has my number. If you need anything at all, you know where I am, Emma. Don't be a stranger.
Chapter 5. The Man. Day 1. Back on the beach. I understand that, Mike. I do. Officer Poole and the photographer for the Brancaster Times have reached an impasse in the car park. Mike Redmond's camera hangs between them from the thick Nikon strap around his neck. I appreciate that you have a job to do, but let us do our job first and then fire away. Does that sound fair? The most important thing is we get this guy taken care of. Could you just put the camera away, please, mate? Mike scowls, obviously not considering Poole to be his mate. Officer Poole shifts his 6'4" frame into Mike Redmond's personal space and gives him his most reasonable look. Come on, mate. Put it away. Mike is unmoved. Look, Mike, the last thing we need is for this guy's family to find out the state he's in the bloody local news. There's a procedure, so can you please delete those and just get back in your car, now. In the distance, an ambulance siren wails closer. Can't do that, mate. Mike smirks, with clearly no intention of deleting anything. Officer Poole exhales loudly and rubs a hand over his face. Oh, come on. Look, we both know how you got here so quick. Play the game, Mike. You've been warned already. I don't know why you keep testing the system. Because we're going to have to charge you at some point. You know you're not supposed to be listening in on airwave. It's an arrestable offence to listen in on police radio, and you know it, mate. I don't know what equipment you're using, but it's not legal. The frequency's supposed to be secure. We will search the office, Mike. I'm serious. We'll come down there and search it. You seriously think the Times are going to let you search their office? On what grounds? You've got absolutely no cause. Personally, I'd check for elite your end, mate. Wouldn't be the first time. Okay, first of all, Mike, you don't work for the Times. You work for the fucking Brancaster Times, so don't get uppity with me. Secondly, if you did work for the Times, you wouldn't be out here arguing with me in a rural car park, would you? So do everyone a favour and put the camera away. Behind Mike at the edge of the car park, an attractive woman stands, finishing a phone call. Poole has been deliberately ignoring her. Now she pushes her long red hair off her shoulder and makes her way towards the driver's side of the only other car in the car park. Chris Poole's face falls. Things are going to get much more complicated now. She's in her early 30s, relaxed and confident as she rests one arm against the open car door and reaches in languidly to pull out a full takeaway coffee from the cup holder. She holds Poole's gaze as she sips. Is there a problem, officer? She purrs. This is Zara Poole, Officer Poole's wife. Zara is the only person that can suck the wind right out of his sails and fill them up again. And after all these years, he still feels like the teenage boy Zara flirted with at school whenever he's around her. She still makes him nervous because, if he's honest with himself, she's the only woman he's ever really wanted to impregnate, but she hasn't let him yet. They've been practicing, obviously, but Zara isn't quite ready to step back from work, meaning power play situations never tend to end in his favour. Z, honey, can you get Mike to stop, please? No pictures, no anything, just let's call it a day now, shall we? Officer Poole holds his wife's gaze, his weary face imploring. Zara? Zara lifts both arms wide. She grins. Out of my hands, sweetheart. Photography is not my department. I just do the words. And, Chris, honey, quick question. Where are your shoes? All eyes travel to Officer Poole's naked feet. Poole gives Zara a look. This is the kind of thing they've talked about before. Undermining him at work. They'll talk about this later. Again. He changes tack. Let his uniform do the talking. All right, that's enough now. I'm going to have to ask you both to get back in your vehicle, please. He ushers Mike back towards the car, his arms wide like a shepherd. Okay, Chris, okay. Zara reluctantly acquiesces. I'm going to have to ask you both remain within your vehicle until the medical crew arrives. Zara slips into the car's leather interior, shaking her head. Unbelievable. An ambulance flashes into sight through the hedgerows. Sir? Officer Poole gestures again to Mike Redman. Sir, if you could also get in the car. The photographer looks through the windscreen to Zara. She nods. A police caution wouldn't sit well at the paper. Mike strolls towards the car as the ambulance roars up towards them, flashing and whirring like a fairground ride. Officer Poole depresses his radio button. Grace, for this is Poole. Ambulance has arrived at access point. Stand by. Over. Poole sets off at a jog to meet the first paramedic as he dismounts from the passenger side. The female driver cuts the siren.
This is Graceford, received. Pulse still stable. No change here, over.
Hypothermia and shock, yes? The paramedic asks Poole. He grabs his kit bag and slams the passenger door in one fluid motion. Yes, both. He could have other injuries. We didn't want to move him. He's currently stable, but unconscious. It's this way. Poole and the male paramedic set off back towards the beach. The female paramedic follows with a stretcher under her arm. Zara leans back into the warm leather of her car seat and sips her hazelnut latte. She slips her mobile phone out of her bag and scrolls through her contacts. She taps out a message and presses send. Mike, still standing outside the car, leans in through the open passenger window. You know him, Zara. Is it worth popping over and grabbing a few more photos, or will he kick off? Zara thinks for a second. Best not. He's a bit crabby at the mo. Just grab some iPhone wobble cam footage. We can pass it off as a member of the public's footage if we use it. Don't be too obvious, though, Mike. She smiles. I don't want a divorce. It's not even a year yet. She watches Mike wander back towards the beach, making his way through the tall grasses on the dunes. Apparently, Mike used to work freelance for the News of the World, when it existed. He only moved back to Norfolk because his mum got sick. She watches his receding back and thinks, there's always been something slightly off about Mike, but at least he gets the job done. Her phone starts to vibrate in her hand. She checks the number and answers. Yeah, so what we've got so far is an unidentified male washed up on the beach. No ID, witness confirmed, an old guy. We caught him before he left and got a statement. Yeah, I've got some story ideas. I'm thinking Brexit angle, illegal immigrant washes up, or broken Britain, middle Englander, failed suicide. Either way, she stops and listens. No, we don't know yet, she carries on. That's the point. If he speaks English, we'll go, you know, no job, la la la. If he's foreign, we'll do the immigration angle. It's fine, whichever. Okay, great. That's great. Listen, I'll get more and put something together. Get it over to you by the end of play. See how you feel. If you want it, it's yours. She takes another slurp of coffee. Yeah, sure, but don't contact me through the office. I'm going to go freelance on this one. Mobile. Great. Okay, Len, I appreciate it. She presses end call and looks out at the swaying grasses of the dune. Mike is nowhere to be seen. The wind slicing through the open window sends a shiver down her spine. She clicks on her heated seat in the stereo, letting the soothing sound of Frank Ocean drift out from the walnut dash. She closes her eyes and drifts, suspended for a moment, lost in her thoughts. A scream rips long and horrifying through the wind and the low mumble of the music. Zara sits bolt upright. Out of her field of vision, on a grassy dune that slopes down to the beach, Mike Redman slowly rises from his crouch to stand, his camera phone still filming. On the beach, the fallen man's screams fly up into the sky. He's regained consciousness, with strange hands on him, all over him. Mid-air, his legs gripped firmly by the paramedics, he twists, spine arching, writhing with every ounce of strength he has left, his legs kicking out, arms lashing, scratching. He screams, as if he's trapped, as if he's being tortured. Officers Poole and Graceford stand lost for words for a microsecond before diving in to assist. Graceford, dropping to her knees in the wet sand, restrains the man's arms, pinning them to his chest, securing the upper body. Poole places his hands down firmly on the man's flailing shins.
Sedative, the male paramedic directs to the other. Got it, she replies, as Poole nods to her.
He has the legs secured, she nods back. Retrieving a small pre-prepped syringe from a Velcro drug roll, she rips at the paper and plastic.
Vein, she calls out.
The male paramedic has already rolled up the left sleeve of the man's wet black top, securing the elbow crease in place.
Ready, he replies.
As the female paramedic leans in, the man screams louder. In the distance, Zara's head, then shoulders, then body rise into view. She stops in her tracks as another scream rips through the air. She pulls her coat tight around her as she stares out across the open expanse of sand to the huddled figures in the distance. Sweet Jesus, she whispers to herself. And suddenly the screaming stops.
Chapter 6. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 6. Peter Chorley. Peter Chorley looks exactly as I'd imagined. A reassuring mixture of tweed, butter and library dust. A kind but sharply intelligent face, Peter is a comfortably dressed Cambridge professor in his 60s. He greets me with a smile, his eyebrows raised mock conspiratorially at the unusual nature of our first meeting. His handshake is firm and surprisingly warm considering the bitter January cold he's come in from. I notice his cheeks are flushed and he's slightly out of breath from his brisk walk from King's Cross Station to the hospital. Thankfully, Peter Chorley doesn't fancy the hospital canteen, so we head back out into the bitter chill of the London streets. I suggest the Welcome Collection Cafe just next door to get us out of the cold quickly. It's a medical museum that boasts the tagline, "A museum for the incurably curious." But they also do great coffee and a nice line in homemade pastries, which hits all my major sweet spots. I've also been coming here since I moved to London to start medical school. These days I tend to pop in and do admin on my laptop when I get one of my increasingly rare breaks. We order our coffees and choose a table overlooking the museum bookshop. Peter stirs a brown sugar into his espresso.
Richard was very keen on you from the get-go, he says judiciously. His first choice. I'll be honest, we had to look you up. We weren't that familiar with your previous work. Case studies, patients, what have you. But it's impressive, your work. And regardless of your relative lack of clinical hours in this exact field, Richard's opinion is trusted. It carries a lot of weight. As you know, he's the go-to on this sort of thing. Has been for years.
A warm feeling spreads through me. I was Richard Groves's first choice. But then I already knew that, didn't I? Still, nice to hear it out loud from someone else. I take a sip of my coffee to try to cover the wave of childlike pride I feel sweeping over me, reminding myself that this is still a job interview, even if it doesn't feel like one. Then I snap myself out of it. After all, I don't even know yet who exactly it is who's interviewing me. I really appreciate you coming all the way down here to meet with me, Peter, I reply. But I have to ask, what exactly is your role in all of this? Richard mentioned you specialise in neurolinguistics. Is that right? You don't have a background in neuroscience yourself. Are you connected to the patient's hospital? I ask, because although very exciting, none of this quite seems to make sense to me yet. The call out of the blue from Groves, the sudden arrival of Peter. I'm not really sure who is asking me to do what. Peter takes a sip of his espresso and gazes out across the bustling cafe before looking back at me.
Ah, yes, sorry. Neurolinguistics, as charged. He gives a pinched smile. No background in your chosen field. but I like to keep up with most areas, or at least try to. His laugh is self-deprecating. For my sins, I've been asked to coordinate on this, to source a specialist. I'm here in a purely advisory role. I see. Yes, it may not look it, but I do have a fair few years of clinical experience under my belt, as they say. But now I just tend to advise on the occasional initiative, and teach, of course. No money in it, of course, he chuckles, but I doubt any of us got into it for that. His eyes twinkle at me knowingly, and I smile back. He's got that right. NHS pay isn't great. For perspective, I earn about as much as the average recruitment consultant in London, and less than the average mortgage advisor. Of course, I could be earning a pack as a Harley Street psychiatrist. I just don't want to. I don't just want a job. I want a vocation. A life. So, you're working for the government on this? The NHS? The civil service? Peter smiles back at me, amused. Yes, I am. There's that twinkle again. Wait, which one? The National Health Service? Or the Civil Service? He holds my gaze, inscrutable. He's not going to tell me who he works for. He's not going to tell me. What the hell is going on? I suddenly get the paranoid feeling that I might be taken for a ride here. I understand the need for patient confidentiality, and the point has been drummed home that this case is going to be tricky in terms of press intrusion, but this is ridiculous. It's obviously Whitehall. Public school children playing at politics. Right, sorry. I'm sorry, Peter, but you're going to have to tell me who exactly you work for, or I'm afraid I'm going to have to pass on this. Peter leans forward quickly in his seat, eager to dispel any worries. Emma, look, I can't stress enough how keen we are to have you on board. They've requested you as a substitute for Richard because they are, and I am, confident you can diagnose and treat this patient in the correct manner. But there are certain things, there is certain information that, well, due to the nature of this case, we'd, or rather they'd, prefer to hold back, at least for now. Until we have some sort of idea what kind of situation we're dealing with here. There is a concern about the identity of this man. Information around it may prove to be sensitive, but we don't know yet. He lets that sit with me a moment before continuing. I am the last person in the world for reveling in the dramatic Dr. Lewis, but if you accept this temporary post, then there will be a substantial amount of, well, of non-disclosure paperwork. His words throw me for a second. I wasn't expecting that. He continues, which I personally may or may not have already signed. Do you see? He taps out a little tune with the flats of his hands on the cafe table. Right, I say carefully. I see. Peter has signed a non-disclosure agreement. There are certain things he can and can't tell me about this case, but why on earth would they have him sign non-disclosure forms? Concern about the patient's identity? Who the hell do they think the guy is? Then you understand my predicament. Good. Peter smiles. We're on the same page. He tips back the last of his espresso and dabs his mouth with a paper napkin. Thank you for your patience with this, Emma. I know it all seems very strange and very sudden. Well, it certainly does to me. He frowns slightly, his eyes drifting over the concourse once more. If there are certain things I can't know, then I think it's about time I heard the things I can know. I straighten up in my seat. So what exactly can you tell me, Peter, about the patient? About the case. Could you give me an overview? Richard suggested retrograde amnesia or fugue, but of course there's the possibility of malingering, which no one has mentioned. He's not faking, Dr. Lewis. If he's a fake, then he's the best malingerer I've seen in my 40 years of medical practice. I examined him yesterday at the hospital. He's not speaking. Hasn't said a word since he turned up. I ran some structural scans on the language processing areas of his brain, but there's no atrophy. I have no idea why he's not talking. He holds my gaze now, all softness gone. The air in the cafe changes and the hairs on the back of my arms rise slightly. This is exciting. Peter delves into the rucksack on the floor next to him and retrieves a slim silver laptop. Have a look, he says. I feel another shiver of excitement fizzle through me as he opens it up and slides it across the table. These are the initial scans. For your eyes only, I mean that. He holds my gaze pointedly until I nod in assurance. I study the screen. A secure medical results site. I scroll down and click on the only file visible, labelled Patient M Scans. Has Groves seen these? I ask. We sent a link through to him yesterday. I don't know if he had a chance to look them over before he passed on the case, but the file portal is password protected. I click on the attachment, and the grey and bright white of a CT scan fills the screen. The delicate crenulations of the patient's brain. Peter's right. There is no atrophy. No areas of brain have died. I look to the hippocampus, the tiny seahorse-shaped mass of tissue nestled under the cerebral cortex, the area of the brain responsible for the creation and storage of our episodic memory. It's the unassumingly small piece of brain tissue responsible for holding a whole human life together. The hippocampus in this scan is intact. There's no physical damage, just the light grey that represents living tissue, not the dark mass of dead cells you'd expect to see on an Alzheimer's or dementia scan. There are signs of a wound and slight contusion at the base of the skull, probably from a fall or a blow. The injury might have been enough to cause a mild concussion, perhaps, but not major damage. It's unlikely to have caused memory loss. But there are no other immediate observable causes on the CT scan. I let my thoughts run with the idea of the concussion. There's the outside chance that if the patient is epileptic, a seizure could have caused his memory loss. But after 6 days, it would have returned. He'd be remembering by now. So if the problem isn't physical or electrical, it must be psychological. Which means this could be a fugue. A real, live fugue patient. His memory loss, in all probability, has been caused by mental trauma, meaning something very bad happened to this man. But then it catches my eye. I see a tiny, dark speck buried in the pituitary gland. I missed it initially, but there it is, faint on the scan. My eyes shoot up to Peter. I know for a fact that this type of pituitary growth has been present on other fugue patients. In previous cases, it's never been given much credence, as pituitary tumours are usually inert. But could the pituitary be linked to fugue? Oh my God. His eyes meet mine, and he raises an eyebrow. Yes, you've seen it. Took me a bit longer. I only noticed it on the train earlier. I had to get my glasses. Tiny. He fishes them out now and swivels the screen around so we can both study the minuscule fleck of darkness on the scan. Yes, obviously, CT is not the ideal imaging to pick this kind of thing up on, but MRI will help us more, he mutters. But then I'm guessing whoever ordered these CT scans wasn't looking for what we've both found. They would have been looking for large-scale brain trauma or atrophy. What we've found appears to be a tiny growth. So easy to miss, nestled in there. Peter looks up from the computer screen. Listen, we can get fresh scans done once you're up there, at the hospital, if you're happy to go up there, he asks. It's a straight-out question, will I go? He's striking while the iron is hot, while I'm intrigued by the material. I studied the scan again. That dark speck. What on earth could that have to do with his memory loss? The pituitary gland has pretty much nothing to do with the hippocampus, nothing to do with memory as far as we know. As far as we know yet. I'm hooked. I look back to Peter. Where do I sign? I grin. But Peter doesn't smile back. In fact, he frowns, looking more concerned than ever. This was really not the reaction I was expecting. And you're sure you're okay with the location? You don't want to ask any more questions. What? Why would I? I now wish more than ever that I'd had a chance to Google the news stories before Peter showed up. I don't even know what hospital the patient's in. Is there something wrong with the location? I don't mean to put you on the spot, Emma. But you don't know what I'm talking about, do you?
You're right. I have no idea what you're talking about, Peter. Sorry. Why would the location be an issue?
I see. Right. My mistake. I just thought you might... Well, I thought you might have changed your mind about the job or had stipulations when you saw more of the details.
What details? I haven't seen any details.
He studies my face. I stare blankly back.
Ah, well then, he continues tentatively. I suppose I had better fill you in.
They found him on Holcombe Beach, Dr. Lewis, near where you grew up. Not too far from where your family home was, it would seem, in Norfolk. I feel my stomach flip, and the room around me spins, because there is no way Peter could know that. Where I came from, where I grew up, who my family was, nobody knows that. I had a different name back then. Before everything happened, before we moved away, how could Peter know where I used to live? Does he know what happened there?
Obviously, Emma, we had to do a background check prior to contacting you. Surprises aren't exactly ideal when the media are already swarming over this case. But needless to say, what happened back then isn't an issue for us if it isn't an issue for you. I wouldn't be here if it were. I just wasn't sure if you'd want to go, to be perfectly honest, considering what happened there.
I feel my face flush. He knows what happened there. I try not to let my breathing change. I try not to let my body betray what I'm feeling. What kind of background check did they do to find that out? That information isn't just available on the internet. But I suppose they have access to old police records.
Yes, I guess he would need to do that, especially if they're worried about the media. It makes sense.
I look down at the table and try and get a hold on myself. I feel my heart thudding in my chest. That's why I came down here in person, you see, Emma. I thought you might need a bit of extra persuading, considering. I turn back to Chorley now. His eyes are flickering across my face, assessing. God knows what he sees there. I'm too busy trying to keep my breathing normal to worry about that. Too busy trying not to think about what exactly his background check threw up. The photos of that night. The aftermath.
I see. I say it slowly and clearly. I hadn't realised. I didn't know it would be up there. To my credit, my voice does not crack. His eyes soften.
I'll totally understand if going back is not something you'd be comfortable with. We could keep looking. I'm happy to tell Richard you weren't available after all. I'm certain he'd understand, and I wouldn't divulge your reasons, obviously. He trails off.
Richard doesn't know, does he?
I blurt. I don't know why this is so important, but it is. Peter gives a concise shake of the head. We don't pass along background check information.
I let out of breath. I hadn't realised I was holding. Thank God. I would hate for Richard, of all people, to know. My brain is whirring. What does this mean? So many good things have happened today. This perfect offer out of the blue, this opportunity, the chance I've been waiting for. But I'd have to go there. Why does it have to be there, of all places in the world? I spent 14 years of my life trying to get away from that place and what happened there. And now I find that the only way forward, the only way out, is back. But could I go back? Is it worth it? I look out at London bustling by the cafe windows, and across the street, outside Euston Station, I see a man and a woman waving as they rush to greet each other. The crowd swirls around them as they hug. There's a cheek kiss. She rumples his hair. He pulls her bobble hat down over her eyes and she laughs. I look back at Peter. I'd need to check with someone else before I say yes. Does that work for you?
Yes, of course, Peter agrees. Of course.
Chapter 7. The Man. Day 1. Hospital.
At the nurse's station, Rhoda, a Trinidadian triage nurse with warm eyes, looks down at the intake notes she's just been handed and carefully squeaks the words, "unknown male," out onto the large triage whiteboard. She adds his priority status next, P2, seriously ill or injured, but not in immediate danger. He also needs a CT scan for his head injury. In cubicle 7, he lies silently curtained off as the ward bustles around him. The unconscious man is hooked up to an IV drip, an oxygen mask cupping his bluing mouth and nose. It mists and clears and mists again with each breath. His wet clothes have been removed and replaced with a crisp medical gown. Metal foil blankets help to slowly raise his core temperature. Rhoda wipes clean the cubicle 4 box, her last patient, discharged. She checks the other priorities on the board. There are 3 P2s on the board. It's a tough call. She checks her watch. She's technically finished her shift. She should call it a day, or rather a morning, but she looks up at the words she's just scrawled out. Cubicle 7. Unknown male. The words snag her interest. Time for one more before she clocks off. It must be fate, she thinks, and nods, scrawling her own name on the whiteboard next to his. As Rhoda turns, the duty nurse catches her eye and raises a comic eyebrow. "Last patient, right? No more," she warns, mock stern. Rhoda smiles. "Last patient, I promise, Maeve. Got to go pick Coco up after the shift." Rhoda thinks of Coco's fluffy little face. Ah, such a good doggy. "Can you call ahead to radiology, Maeve?" Rhoda asks. "Book the CT. We'll get that done first, and hopefully ICU will have space by then. And Maeve, could you page up another doctor? That junior house doctor is still up to his eyeballs with that missing finger situation. He isn't going anywhere soon." Maeve lets out an unexpected burst of laughter and sets about calling radiology. Rhoda grabs the unknown man's medical notes again and breaks into a gentle jog back towards cubicle 7, her white nursing shoes squeaking across the linoleum. "Oh, and a porter, please," she calls behind her as she disappears out of Maeve's sight. In cubicle 7, Rhoda works fast, a series of actions she's gone through multiple times over the last 30 years, pulse, blood pressure, fluids, ready for transfer. She looks through his entry notes again. She reads the notes on his behaviour in more depth. Disorientated, aggressive, highly agitated, and non-responsive. Excellent. What a wonderful combination to end the shift with, she thinks. Well, we'll just have to see what we can do with you. The patient's breathing changes infinitesimally in depth. Rhoda looks up from the clipboard. Oh, God. The man begins to stir under the blankets. The notes say, "Patient has been slipping in and out of consciousness for approximately 35 to 40 minutes. There may not be long to get him transferred before he wakes up again, and this all gets slightly more complicated." She pokes her head out through the cubicle curtains. "Porter, now, please!" she calls louder this time. Behind her, the man shifts in his bed. Rhoda sighs. He's waking. Looks like it's happening now, regardless. She moves around to the man's bedside and steels herself. He stirs again, and suddenly his eyelids flick open. He looks directly at her. She smiles down at him. "Hello, you." Her tone is gentle, maternal. "How are you feeling?" The man stares up at her warm face floating above him. He takes it in, studying it. He was on the beach, and now he's here. His brow slowly knits as he looks at her, her kind eyes, the small scar hidden in her hairline. Does he know her? No, he doesn't know her. Rhoda watches the realization flash across his face. "My name is Rhoda. I'm your nurse. You're in a hospital now, but there's no need to worry. You're fine. Everything's all right. I'm just here to help you, okay? That's all I'm here for. Now, you had a little knock to the head, but we're going to get it all sorted out. Everything's going to be just fine." A knock to the head. His eyelids flicker in concern. Nothing too serious, Rhoda counters. Nothing for you to worry about just now. All you need to do is lie there all cozy and let me do everything. Have a nice relax and let me do it all. Do you understand? You're in safe hands with me. His muscles slacken back into the bed as he stills himself. He blinks up at her and lets out a sigh that clouds his oxygen mask. Trust me? Rhoda asks. He looks up at her and she looks straight back down, solid and safe. His eyes fill, and when he blinks, tears run in two rivulets down either side of his face. He exhales deeply again and tries to raise his arm. Rhoda rests a hand on it lightly. She feels the quiver of his muscles beneath the sheet. Okay then, that's a deal. You trust me, and I'll get you all fixed up. Shall I? He blinks at her slowly, consenting. What the hell happened to you? She wonders, and moves her warm hand to his shoulder. Do you remember banging your head? Do you remember that? The man closes his eyes to concentrate, breath momentarily held. He looks back at Rhoda. There's only thinly masked confusion. He can't remember. It's okay, she soothes. It's okay if you don't remember that. That's perfectly normal after a bang to the head. It doesn't mean a thing. We're going to get you nice and warm and do a quick scan to your head to see what's what. How does that sound? Does that sound like a good idea? He grimaces. Yeah, maybe no nodding, Rhoda soothes. That's where the knock is, on the back of your head. It's not a big one, but it'll be a bit sore for a while. So no more nodding, okay? You just relax. He blinks in acknowledgement. No more nodding. She throws her gaze out towards the ward and seems to reach a decision. Right, you know what? Let's just get going without them. She releases the foot brake on the hospital trolley and smiles. If there's no porters, then I'm just going to have to take you over for the scan myself. If you want a job done right. She pulls back the curtains. Chapter 8. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 6. Joe. Isn't it funny how you can successfully not think about something for months or even years? You can almost forget. Almost. And then one simple sentence or word can bring it all back with a sudden, sickening immediacy. Peter and I say our goodbyes outside the cafe and I head back to the hospital, my mind whirring. I need to center myself. It's just that I wasn't expecting to be confronted with the worst moments of my life. Not today, not when things seem to be going so well. I scan the lobby as I enter. Faces, so many faces, all with their lives and their own stories. I try to shake off the feeling that everyone who sees me knows exactly what happened 14 years ago. I try to shake off the sharp shame of it, the dread, the feeling I've managed to avoid for so long. Even if sometimes memories of it stop me in my tracks on Oxford Street, my Christmas shopping bags trembling in hand as strangers swirl around me. Or make me fall silent mid-sentence in restaurants with countless prospective boyfriends. Even if they make me question my instincts in every aspect of my personal life and mean that my only freedom, my only escape is through work. Even if they are the reason I have chosen to live alone, in case, just in case, somehow, I make it all happen again. Like anyone in recovery, I try to be wary of certain people, places and things. And somehow, over the years, I've managed to not reveal it, but to keep it all inside. The sadness and the regret, like a gaping hole inside me. I take the glass lift up to the third floor, watching the heads of patients and visitors recede beneath me, and feel my familiar stomach flip of vertigo. My primal fear of heights snaps me back to reality. A decision needs to be made. Peter will be waiting for my phone call this evening. I'm going to need an answer by then. Do I stay and keep pretending none of it ever happened? Or do I go and face the past and perhaps make something good of it?
The lift doors open, and I head down the corridor to my office. Millie isn't at her desk when I round the corner. I check my watch. Oh yeah, lunchtime. She won't be back for a good half hour yet. I need to speak to Joe. Joe's who I need. I flick on my office lights, lock the door, and sink into my chair. On the desktop, I bring up FaceTime, wiping the dust and various marks from the screen and camera with my sleeve. I guess it's been a while since I've needed to make a video call. Joe is my brother, and whenever I make a big decision in life, it's Joe I tend to run it by. Don't get me wrong, though. I'm not saying I ever actually follow his advice, but I at least know that whatever advice Joe gives, he'll give it to me straight. And that's what I need right now. I need another person's gut reaction. Plus, Joe is the only one who knows about Norfolk. Well, Joe and Mum and Dad. I've never told another person what happened. I don't think I'm even allowed to. Which has made relationships hard, to say the least. That and the job, and the time it gobbles up so greedily. My last proper relationship was with an orthopaedic surgeon, Harry. It lasted 3 years. He was easy to spend time with, but I didn't want to marry him, so, yeah. I don't have someone like that just now. Joe has a family. He's a husband and a dad, which is great. I'm an auntie. Joe's got ties, responsibilities, connections. I do not. So I've sort of come to value his opinion more as the years go by. He seems, for want of a better word, happy. I pull his name up on contacts and shrug off my coat. I take a stab at fixing my hair in the dark reflection of the screen and press call. Joe lives in Hertfordshire, about 25 minutes from my mother's house. I couldn't do that, but I suppose it must be handy for babysitting. I know he'll be in. He works from home. He's an architect who has the good fortune to be able to pick and choose the projects he works on, which is convenient now that they have little Chloe to look after. The electronic bounce of the FaceTime call tone cuts out sharply, and Joe's face replaces mine on the screen.
There you are.
Joe's one of those people who always answers their phones, no matter how busy they are. He's reliable that way. I admire that level of accessibility, because I am not one of those people. He beams at me. I expand the pixelating window until his smiling face fills my screen. His glasses are at a crazy angle on the top of his head, his hair dishevelled. I needn't have worried about mine. Here I am, I call in response. Our greeting. He catches sight of himself in his own window and sets about mushing his hair. He's always been a hair musher. He's only 31, and yet he somehow managed to look like a harassed 30-year-old since his second year at uni.
So, where exactly have you been for the last week, Missy? Thought you'd at least call when you got back to London after Christmas.
He continues typing as he talks, as if I'm right there in the room with him. Sorry, work. I shrug a what can you do, and Joe glances up, frowning. We spent Christmas together at Mum's, the whole family, and I didn't call when I got back because, well, life, I suppose. Actually, probably work. Things get surprisingly busy in hospitals around the festive season. Joe isn't impressed.
Right. Well, just so you know, Mum started checking the traffic news for crashes. Make of that what you will.
Listen, Joe, I need your advice. Something has come up. But you've got to promise me you won't tell Mum, all right?
What are we, seven?
He chuckles. I need you not to tell her, Joe, please. There's urgency in my voice and his smile fades slightly.
What is it, Em?
He asks, instantly serious. I've been offered a new job and I don't know if I should do it, or even if I want to do it, so I don't want you mentioning it to her. I don't want her to worry about it. I don't want her going through anything she doesn't have to. The thing is, I might have to go back to Norfolk. His gaze hardens at the word.
Why?
He asks bluntly. It's a good question. If I didn't have his full attention before, I have it now. He stares at me grimly as if he's seen a ghost, and in a way, he has. We don't talk about the past. All that got left behind with the house. It's a job opportunity, Joe. A big one. Have you seen the news?
He's silent for a moment before he speaks.
Yes, I have. Why? Which story? This isn't to do with the dead girl on Hampstead Heath, is it?
He looks away, rubs his eyes, suddenly tired. What dead girl on Hampstead Heath? God, another thing I haven't heard about. And Hampstead Heath isn't too far from my flat, either. I really need to start watching the news.
No, it's nothing to do with a girl on Hampstead Heath. Joe, they found a man on a beach near Holcombe. They have no idea who he is or where he's come from, and neither does he, apparently. Like the piano man in Kent. You remember him, right?
The guy on the news? You mean Matthew, right? Yeah. That's happening in Holcombe, is it? Jesus, I thought this one was in Kent too. Shit. Must have got those two stories mixed up in my head. Yeah, I've seen the story. Yeah, Matthew, such a weird story.
Wait, Matthew? Hang on, Joe. What do you mean, Matthew? Are you saying the guy on the beach is someone named Matthew? How do you know that?
Joe scowls, baffled by my flurry of questions. Joe, nobody knows what his name is, or who he is. That's the point of them hiring me. I mean, they're calling him Mr. Nobody, so how the hell do you know what his real name is? Literally everyone seems to know more about my potential patient than I do.
What are you talking about, Em? Matthew's not his actual name. That's what they're calling him at the hospital. I guess they can't call him Mr. Nobody in a hospital, can they? Apparently, his nurse started calling him Matthew and it stuck. I suppose they've got to call him something, but it's all a bit, well, a bit stupid, to be honest.
Joe rumples his hair.
They call him Matthew because apparently something odd happened in the hospital,
he says skeptically.
I don't know.
He studies my face and puts two and two together.
You're seriously thinking about taking this job, and you haven't even researched it yet, have you?
My brother can read me like a book. No, no, I have not, I admit tentatively.
Let me guess, because of work.
Yes, work, that is correct. He sighs.
Well, Emmy, you're in for a treat when you finally do get round to it. It's an absolute shit show up there. Go Googling. The press are already camped out there. It's a media circus. That piano man case on crack. Oh, and Matthew means gift from God, by the way. Just so you know the level of crazy we're working on here.
He studies me, disapproval written large across his lovely old face. He sighs again loudly.
I'd say run a nautical mile from this crap, but something tells me you've already made your mind up, and you just want me to agree with you. Don't you?
I smile penitently. Yeah, I think you're right, Joe. I think I do. There's no use lying to him. I've never been able to anyway.
Can you handle going back, though, Em? Seriously. I mean, really, can you handle it? I know you'll say you can, and you'll make it work somehow, but could you?
If I'm honest, I don't know, Joe. I won't know until I get there, I suppose. But I have to give it a try, don't I?
No! No, you don't have to give it a try, Em. Sometimes you can just let things go. Let an opportunity go if it's not right for you. Sometimes it's not a test or a challenge or whatever. Sometimes it's just you pushing yourself too far.
I know deep down he'd want me to do everything differently from the start. That if he'd had his say, I wouldn't even have gone into medicine. I'd been an artist, a painter. I was good at art when we were young. But things happened, life happened, and here we are. We're so different, he and I. It's funny how different two people with the same genes can be.
Well, I do have to do it, Joe.
You don't, but okay. That's your answer then. Do it. I'll be here if you need me.
Then his brows crease.
But what will you do if they find out what happened? There's a lot of press up there, Em.
They changed our names, Joe. No one will know who I was or that I was ever there before. That's why we moved, right? The police, the social workers, that was the point, wasn't it? That nobody would find out. Unless the police themselves decide to tell the media, there's no way anyone will be able to find out. The system is in place for a reason. He frowns, unconvinced.
But you'll be there, physically, in person, with people who knew us back then, people who went to school with us. What if someone recognises you?
I hadn't thought of that. I stare at him now, silenced. But I was so different back then. It was such a long time ago, and I looked different, a different person, a different name. I lost my puppy fat at 17, right after we left. My once open, soft face lost its plump, rosy cheeks and matured. Cheekbones, collarbones, breasts. I grew into myself. Boys started noticing me. I'm certain nobody will recognise me now. They won't, Joe. They'll remember an awkward 16-year-old. I mean, I'd like to think I might have changed slightly over the last 14 years. He studies my face, as if trying to judge whether I'm right, then nods back tentatively. I do look different. I often wonder if he misses the old me, the me from before. But that girl's gone. I plough on. And even if they do recognise me, Joe, so what? We'd be all over the news for what, like maybe a week, tops? No longer than we were before. And then it just goes away, and the world moves on, and we go back to our lives. I can handle that. We handled it before. All of us.
We did. But I don't know if Mum can do all that again. She's happy where she is. I don't think she could just go back to her life if who she was got out.
I think of Mum in her cosy cottage. I think of her coffee mornings with her friends, her Pilates group, the quiet life she's built around herself in her small village. No one there knows. And I remember too how, like me, at the end of every day she goes home to an empty house. Her friends are all she has. If the truth came out, things would change for her. Could she handle that again? If I do this, I could ruin all of that for Mum. But then what? Never take a job in the spotlight for fear that our secret comes out, our dirty secret. Agree to stay quiet, stay hidden until when? I feel the burn of injustice in my chest.
Wait, Em, does whoever offered you the post know who you are?
Who I am? I take a breath before answering. Yeah.
Em, why would they choose you for this job if they knew what happened in Norfolk? I thought they didn't want a media circus.
I cut him off. They don't, Joe. And for the record, they chose me because I'm bloody good at my job, okay? And they're concerned it might be a problem for me.
I know you're good at your job. But who are these people?
He holds my gaze questioningly, insistently. He's not going to let this go.
You don't know their motives on this. They must have chosen you for a reason. Plenty of other people are good at their jobs.
I take a breath. I was recommended. Look, Joe, are you asking me not to do this? I say it with a calm I don't feel, my heart hammering. Because it's not just this job you're asking me not to do, is it, Joe? I'd have to turn down any job that puts me in the spotlight. I'd have to turn down anything high profile, wouldn't I? Because if I wander out into the light, then the spotlight shines on all of us, doesn't it? I hear myself saying it. Oh, God, I didn't mean to turn this conversation into that conversation. I feel a rush of remorse. Sorry, Joe. I don't know why I'm taking this out on you. It's ridiculous. Sorry. I want this. I can't know I'm good enough and then just walk away. What happened was not our fault. Why should we have to spend the rest of our lives paying for it? He takes a moment before replying.
Look, Em, you shouldn't ever hold yourself back because of it. But...
He stops himself and shakes his head. But what, Joe? Say it.
But...
He continues very carefully.
And I say this because I love you, Em, and you know I do. You need to ask yourself why you need this so much. Why you need the spotlight. Just ask yourself what you're so desperately looking for, if it's even out there. If you go back to Norfolk, I'll deal with Mum, don't worry about that. I'll explain it to her and she'll be okay with it, I promise. But you really need to try and understand why you're going back at all. What you're looking for there.
None of this is about Norfolk, Joe. I'd go wherever the job was. I wish it wasn't there, obviously, but I'm not going to let that stop me. And it's not like I have a lot of reasons to stay here in London. I want more than all this. For myself. For my career. I'm really good at what I do, Joe. And I'm going to help this man. That's why I'm going. He studies me, concern in his warm eyes.
First, be very sure you know exactly who it is you're helping, Em.
Chapter 9, The Man. Day 1, The Search Begins. Back at the beach, a silence falls between police officers Poole and Graceford. It's Graceford who speaks first. Don't worry, I'll talk to them. She nods back towards Mike and Zara, who have now made their way from the dunes to meet them. Graceford gives Poole a rallying clap on the back as she passes. She'll take over. Poole hears their voices behind him, but thankfully their words are just out of his earshot. He turns to see how Zara's taking it. Her usually beautiful face is pulled into a tight pinch as Graceford speaks. Poole turns away. Zara has always had a problem with Graceford. A car door slams. He turns to look and Mike is in the car now. Zara still leaning on the car door, half in, half out, nodding reasonably. She smiles sweetly at Graceford before swiveling into the driving seat and slamming the door closed. Zara's car rolls with pointed slowness out of the car park past them. Gone. No goodbye then, Poole thinks. So? He asks as Graceford rejoins them. So, she answers flatly and changes the subject. What do you think about the man on the beach? She avoids Poole's gaze, casting her own back towards the sea path. At best, she's trying to keep things professional, at worst, sparing his feelings. He tries again. What did she say? He gestures out in the direction of the long-gone car. Graceford clears her throat, looks away again. If she's honest with herself, the nuances of other people's relationships have never really been her strong point, but she understands that she is expected, in this type of situation, to give some kind of response to Chris's question. She's supposed to have some kind of opinion. Reluctantly, she obliges. She said, sure, no problem, officer. I mean, what else is she supposed to say to me? I'm a police officer, and she's breaking the law. Officer Poole looks down at the loose gravel of the car park. Shit. They've been warned, Chris, Graceford continues. No one at the station cares she's your wife, and neither do I. She can't keep doing it. She's wasting police time. Graceford shifts uncomfortably. She can't tell if she's said too much. Poole's still staring down at the ground. They're breaking the law, and they keep doing it. Poole raises his head. I know, Beth, I know, believe me, I know they are. But I've said that to her. You've heard me say it to her, haven't you? Beth Graceford nods and looks away. Poole knows that means the conversation is over. He clears his throat and pulls himself together. Okay, right, he says, changing his tone. Let's get going, shall we? That beach isn't going to search itself. Is that spare uniform still in the boot of the patrol car? Graceford nods. Neil's spare uniform? Yeah, of course it is. A mischievous smile plays across Chris's face. Remind me why I kept it there? He asks, as barefoot he follows Graceford gingerly across the stony gravel. You know this, Chris. In case someone vomited on him. She intones it like someone who's told the story 1,000 times and knows what's coming next. She pops open the hatchback. Graceford had previously been partnered with Sergeant Neil Jarvis for the first 5 months of her posting on the Norfolk coast. Chris's grin broadens. In case someone vomited on him.
That happened a lot, did it? Enough to warrant the extra uniform?
Yeah, it did actually, Chris. It happened to Neil an above average amount of times, so yeah, it did warrant the uniform. Graceford says with the weary authority of a recurrent eyewitness.
Okay, then. Poole nods sagely. Fair enough in that case, I suppose.
She rummages around in the back of the car. I'm not sure why he left it, though. Maybe because of all the vomit that's been on it. Size 9 boot, okay?
Guess he'll have to be.
Chris takes the boots, and leaning against the patrol car to brush the gravel from his feet, slides his sockless feet into the cold leather.
I suppose we should go and look for this guy's stuff, then. What do you reckon his story is? Homeless? Attempted suicide?
Nah, neither, I don't think. He didn't look homeless. Chris nods.
No, he didn't.
Chris would never say it out loud, but he'd been surprised the guy had been good-looking. Well, all right looking for a bloke. Not that good-looking guys didn't try and commit suicide too, he supposed. Graceford locks the car.
It all had a bit of a weird vibe, don't you think?
I don't know. Anyway, let's see what we can find, she sighs. It's a big stretch of beach. I'll call it in and you make a start, Chris. Chris climbs to the crest of the dune and the wide, flat expanse of Holcombe Beach spreads into view. It's even windier up here. Still, he can hear the sound of his own heartbeat in his ears from the exertion. Inside his new boots, his toes are reluctantly coming back to life. He can see right out to the offshore wind farm a mile out to sea, the monolithic forest of turbine arms rotating with the weight of the North Sea wind. He closes his eyes and sucks in a deep breath, then lets it out. Best make a start, he decides. He opens his eyes and scans the landscape, looking for anything the man might have left behind. A pile of warm clothes, a bag. But there isn't anything. Nothing but outcrops of seaweed littering the beach, dark clumps of debris washed ashore. It's hard to pick out details from this distance. It's possible any one of them could be clothes, perhaps shoes, or a rucksack containing a wallet, a phone, or keys. He turns back to Graceford, still on the edge of the forest path, radio in hand. He can't hear what she's saying, but he watches her mouth move. She's probably talking about Zara and Mike, about how the local press always seem to arrive suspiciously early these days, just after a police call goes out, in fact. Chris wishes he'd never mentioned the whole thing to Zara in the first place. They'd been at home watching a Netflix true crime. He'd been trying to impress her, and he'd stupidly mentioned that it was, in fact, possible to hack into and listen to the UK police radio system, too. It was just a stupid passing comment. He'd been showing off. That had been about a month ago now. But after they'd binge-watched that show, Zara had just started showing up places right after Chris got there. And it hadn't been only Chris's calls either. Other people had started to notice too. He hadn't asked outright how she was doing it. He didn't want her to tell him, because then he would definitely have to arrest her, which wouldn't be great after only a year of marriage. God knows how she got hold of the illegal radio equipment she must be using. He watches Graceford in the distance. But what can he do? It's hard not to speak to the press when you wake up next to it, he thinks, when it crawls all over you in expensive underwear. When you do your morning pee while it brushes its teeth. It's hard not to talk to the press when it looks like Zara and you're married to it. Best to focus on the job at hand, finding out who this guy is. Graceford looks up from the walkie-talkie and sees him staring. She raises her hand. A thumbs up. It's okay for now, Chris decides. Maybe he'll try another chat with Zara tonight. He looks at the beach, at the dark clumps scattered along its 2-mile stretch, and makes his way down the steep dune to the first one. Chapter 10. Dr. Emma Lewis. Day 7. Into the woods. It's a long drive to Norfolk, but the morning traffic loosens after London, and cool January sunlight streams across the miles of empty English countryside as they roll past my car window. As I get closer, motorways turn into A roads, then B roads, and soon I'm winding right out onto the coastal way, flanked on one side by an ancient oak forest, and on the other side by the vast plains of salty beach marshes that stretch out into the North Sea. I collected the rental car earlier this morning. Someone from Peter Chorley's office arranged it. It's all been made very easy for me. I just have to follow the reassuring voice of the satellite navigation towards the accommodation someone else has arranged for me in Norfolk. Above the glittering wet marshes, flocks of birds soar as I drive past, thousands of black pixels continually reconfiguring against the crisp blue winter sky, always almost on the verge of making sense. I crack my window and let the scent of the countryside roll in, salt sea air mixed with the warm, earthy forest mulch, and on its edges, the rich scent of bonfire. It hits me before I can anticipate it, the memory, the smell of burning leaves in the cold air, the crackle and spark. I try not to think of it, and the sharp, sad ache that always comes with the memory. I close the window and blast the heater on. When I get to the postcode Peter emailed me, all I can do is pull up on the verge of the B road and stare at it, engine burring along, the indicator clicking out time. It's not what I expected, but the GPS reassures me I have reached my destination. I don't know what I was expecting exactly. Perhaps sterile student digs or a room in a hospital's on-site student nurse accommodation. In front of the car sits a little wooden sign. The sign points off the main road and down a thin gravel track leading into the heart of the woods. The sign, at a slight angle, reads, Cuckoo Lodge. Okay. No one mentioned that name in the email, which is slightly strange. But then everything about this situation has been strange so far, so why break with tradition? Luckily, there's no other traffic on the main road, so I have a moment alone to reassess. I turn off the engine and scroll through Peter's text to check the postcode again. Did he mention a cuckoo lodge in his text message? His email gives only the sat-nav coordinates and the address 1 Market Lane. I look up at the gravel lane through the windscreen. Is that Market Lane? Definitely doesn't look like it leads to a market, unless it's a market in the woods. Did I type the postcode in wrong? I check the sat-nav postcode against the text info. No, it's all correct. I look down the bumpy little lane again. Dark woods rise high on both sides. It's literally in the middle of nowhere. This can't be right, can it? Why would Peter put me here? I mean, it's not exactly near the hospital or accessible in terms of local amenities, is it? I better make sure I stock up on food if this is it, because the nearest village, Wells Next the Sea, is a good 20 minutes drive from here. But there's only one way to find out if this is it, I suppose. I restart the car, check my rearview mirror, and bump down off the tarmac and onto the crunchy gravel of the lane. 1 Market Lane, here I come. I'm sure there's a reason Peter's put me in the middle of nowhere. I guess he wants me as far from the media and therefore the hospital as possible. Makes sense. I'll certainly be safely tucked away from the Princess Margaret Hospital. And I'd be lying if I said I hadn't been worried about ending up near Holt, near our old family home. It's impossible to say what effect seeing the old house would have. I haven't been back there since it happened. We didn't even go back for our things at the time. They wouldn't let us. I won't go back now either if I can avoid it. I decide Peter must have partly chosen this location on my behalf. He'll have put me here so I don't even have to drive past my old home every day. Good old Peter. I smile to myself. I let down the window again. I need to wake up. The breeze flows in, bringing the scent of mulched earth and dead leaves with it. No more bonfires for now. The lane's longer than I had expected. The tall trees flank my car on both sides. The forest beyond on either side is dense. I'm right in the heart of the Norfolk National Nature Reserve.
These woods go on for miles in either direction. I catch a rustling of motion in the undergrowth beside the car as it crackles along the gravel. At least no one can sneak up on you out here, which is reassuring. You definitely hear them coming. A bird bursts from the woods to my right, soaring high across the track ahead, and then I see it. Cuckoo Lodge. The lane ahead opens out into a small clearing, where the house looms, majestic, framed by forest. It's unexpectedly beautiful, placed right in the centre of the dark clearing at the end of the long lane, an intricate little red brick house hidden in the woods, a neo-Gothic Victorian dream, with a wooden gable over its front door, chocolate box chimney stacks, and an engraved Yorkstone plaque between its two uppermost windows, commemorating the date it was built. I squint up through the windscreen, but it's too far away to read yet. I shiver and close the car window. There's a chill in the air now. The building might be the most perfectly symmetrical thing I've ever seen. A gingerbread house made real, its dark windows reflecting the sky. There's a low wooden fence encircling the house at waist height, a small hinged gate at its centre. I pull the car up to the left of the clearing, as close to the grass verge as I can. It feels rude parking here, but I don't know where else to go. The road simply stops outside the house. I turn off the engine. Silence floods the car. I let it soak in for a moment, before popping the door open and stepping out. Now that I'm closer, I see the stone plaque reads, Cuckoo Lodge, 1837. 1837, that's weird. I don't know many historical dates, but I do know that this was the year the young Queen Victoria succeeded to the throne. Which is bizarre, because off the top of my head, the only other historical dates I know are 1066 and 1492. And it suddenly occurs to me how strange